it's my way of expressing appreciation for everybody's presence here, in particular my colleagues, members of parliament across the political spectrum. Welcome everybody. In case you are not sure what the purpose of the meeting is, it is a meeting of the Standing Committee on the Auditor General, and we have had a series of engagements with the Auditor General. Today, specifically, our business is to reflect on the strategic plan proposed by the Auditor General for the next year, that is 2010, for the next 5 years, for the next 3 years. You can see I'm wobbling a bit, still early in the morning. I suppose they'll tell us why for 3 years, not for a year, or not for 5 years, or for 10 years. So probably that's where they'll start. Colleagues, also, I have requested that a document be distributed to all of you so that you can have a look at it and reflect on it. We had proposed that in developing our program for oversight, that we piggyback with the AG's program for their roadshow, where they'll be visiting different legislatures, municipalities in the province, so that we see if we cannot find synergy in our program. Our agenda would be specifically to do our own oversight work. Now, Adele came with, gave us, or let me rather say the AG's office, gave us their list of dates, scheduling of meetings, which already starts with yesterday. Now, they go until the 4th and the 5th of November, which is the first week of our recess. So it's a bit tricky. Until when?
4th and 5th of November is that recess?
Yes, I thought that recess is not.
Recess is from the 23rd of November only.
Oh, so it's actually still within. Yeah, all right. Okay. Sorry for misleading the house. Just not deliberately misleading the house. But now we obviously time has become, already a lot has already happened. I don't know how many visits how far can our budget take us as far as the visits are concerned from our side. And how many people are available for what day. But reflect on that. For what it's worth, next week we should be able to find time to agree on whether we are able to do this, to join them, and on which day, where. And if it's completely impossible, I suppose we would then have to schedule our own oversight program. Which again, ideally, we should be accompanied by some senior officials from the AG's office when we visit some of those municipalities or legislatures. So we're going to have to work on this and see how best we can accommodate, our own program. All right. Is there any other preliminary issues that anybody wants to raise before we afford the AG an opportunity to do his presentation? Sorry? Somebody. Yes, Chief.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I just wanted to know, I see we received another document here. Scott, is this going to be the slide presentation?
Yeah. What you had previously is the, what they call it, something like blue book. I don't know why it's called blue. The AG will have to explain. But in addition, we have a printout of the slides that they'll be presenting, that's my understanding. And that's what you've got. So it's just simply talking to the document that you received previously. Is there anybody who does not have a copy of the actual strategic plan? Because that would have been distributed some time back. If you have difficulty, just indicate to the official so that they can assist you. All right, without wasting... Yes, Mr.
Sorry, can they also then cross-reference from the document we received now and the other one? Because some of us have done our workings on the document we received, so if they need to cross-reference.
Yeah, it's always a challenge a presentation does not become a readout of the original document, whether it's the annual report or the strategic plan, because that would be very detailed. It would take a couple of days to do. So what happens is that they then highlight the key salient issues through a presentation. What I would recommend is that if members are struggling to follow and they want to understand where something that's being said is anchored in relation to the principal document, the blue book, then they should be able to stop the presenter so that they can be guided as to where we are. I think that way might just be, because to cross-reference every word sentence that they might just be a bit cumbersome, unless they are able to, you know, do it with ease in some situations. So let's find some kind of a happy medium somewhere. Would that kind of take us somewhere? Deputy AG, are you comfortable with that arrangement?
Thanks very much, Chair. I think it'll work because what we've done in extracting the presentation, we have basically extracted the bulk of what's in the presentation from the principal strategic plan document. Okay. And the chapters that are contained in the strategic plan document are exactly the same chapters that we're going to deal with here. So nothing will supersede the strategic planning document. So if there are questions and members have worked on the strategic plan document, we'll still be able to ourselves go back to that document to answer whatever question. So we've just basically extracted this so that we can at least have an easy engagement with the meeting.
All right. Everybody happy? Yeah. Honorable Sosibo?
Thank you, Chief Justin. I would like to know which one is the principal document. It's the last one before the 16th or the 15th of September. Thank you.
All right. All right. Now we can hit the ground running. Please proceed. I don't know. All right. The AG.
We are left-handed.
The left is their way at last.
Yeah, the left-handed people are especially talented when it comes to dexterity. All right.
Thank you, Chair. I guess today is also another important day in our calendar because it's one of the two events that characterize our statutory engagement with COWET. Following the annual report a few weeks ago, now today is the strategic plan. And with this engagement, let me perhaps state up front, Chair, that it's a preliminary engagement of which COWEC will still have another 2 months to chew on the judgment before they make a final conclusion on it. Because we are expected to deliver it 6 months before the end of our year, and COWEC has got another 2 months to go through it and then finalize it. So in the event there are still unclear messages in the document, we still have that opportunity to purify it before it becomes an official table document in the House.
Obviously, because it will be the first engagement on it, but not only that, because a whole lot of us are still new and finding our feet into this environment. You have to have the last one. All right. So I think it would help us having received the presentation to go and reflect on it and possibly schedule another round where we can then come with any specific proposals, if any, on a second round of engagement. I seem to understand you to be suggesting such a possibility. But please proceed.
Yes, if it's possible, Chair, but I do trust that today will provide most of the clarity. And without avoiding another session, but just to say that we will be willing to engage if there's a need to do so. But today is meant ready to respond to most of the areas that are critical and for SCOWEC to note and apply their mind to. In making a determination of the comfort with this particular document.
Yeah. Yeah. And I suppose you start by mapping the key features of the document up front so that we have a sense of what are the main chunks that we're going to be grappling with. All right, please proceed.
My understanding is that the session today will be threefold. The first part will be to go through the strategic document itself in as much detail as possible, guided by these slides, which will point us in the right direction. The second part will be to look specifically at the principles that have been followed in determining the tariffs, which are a requirement of SCOWEC to approve, because the tariffs inform and determine the budget for the office, the revenue that we expected to earn, as well as expenditure that has been used as a build-up to the tariffs for both the firms as well as the office staff itself. The third aspect is expected to look at the audit directive.
The funding model that we was alluded to last week when we're looking at the annual report when it's touching the tariff.
Yes, it will be the one element of the funding model, but just the most important one, because everything that we incur the cost will have to be incorporated into the tariff in order for us to determine the recovery levels as well as the margins that we need to retain. So in a way, it's an embodiment of the entire operations of the office in basically a two-page tariff structure.
Yeah.
So it is quite an important aspect indeed to be considered here.
All right.
But we'll dwell on that when we go through the build-up to the tariffs and the logic behind and the key assumption behind the numbers that have been arrived at. The third aspect relates to the audit directive, which is also another requirement of the Public Audit Act to be approved by SCOWEC. It is the requirement of the Public Audit Act for the audit directive of the public sector audits throughout the country to be established by the Auditor General and approved by SCOWEC. So we'll also take you through the principles that informed that directive, which is expected to be followed by all the auditors that audit public sector entities throughout the country. So it's a is a handful of critical approvals that SCOWEC will need to consider, which will give us a pave the way for our implementation come April 2010 in the new financial year.
Before you proceed, I just want to make sure that my army is on the same wavelength with you at this juncture, because these are all tasks that the military must actually execute. Colleagues, you would recall that by virtue of serving on this committee, there are certain responsibilities that are bestowed on you. Now, what the AG is going to present today are tools that he needs to do his work. We now are charged with the responsibility on behalf of Parliament to examine those tools that he's proposed to see whether we are convinced that those tools would enable him to discharge his responsibility. Now, the main document is the strategic plan, which is his plan of how he's going to execute for the next period. It says 2010 to 2013. But the second one, which requires our specific approval, and you must note that because it's important, there is a funding model that outlines, because remember, the Auditor General does not come, does not receive a budget from Minister Pravin Gordhan, except under exceptional circumstances where he goes broke and he has to be rescued like the other parastatals that have come and asked for rescue. But ordinarily, he should be able to lift himself with his own bootstraps. He must be able to generate his own revenue. And he does so by charging a fee wherever he provides a service. And some of these entities don't have money to pay, like municipalities, especially the small ones. So he'll always have problems with his debt collection department. Now, he must come with a funding model now. That funding model includes a set of tariffs that say for services that we render, this is what we charge, whether per hour or whatever. He'll tell us how that tariff system works. Now, once he's motivated what kind of tariff system he's proposing and why and so on, how sustainable it is, we then must then respond and say, we think it's a fair tariff. We think the municipalities and everybody else can afford it, or we think it's unfair. You know, like Eskom, when it raises the tariffs of electricity, and what is it, NERSA, that must now approve them. So we're in more or less a similar situation. That's your second task. The third task that confronts you today relates to the auditing system. What do you call it? The audit directive. Essentially, as I understand it, because in a sense I'm trying to help myself here so that let alone helping everybody else. The Auditor General goes and audits people and then comes and reports and say this one complied, that one did not comply. But before he does that, there has to be agreement as to what are the rules of the game. On what basis does he audit? What does he look for, and for what reason? You know, what format must he approach? You know, all those questions. I'm using layman's understanding of auditing. You know, this is the lawyer's version of auditing 101. Right? Now, so essentially the rules of the game. Now. The rules that he then adopts as to how he's going to audit everybody. He must first present that to us, and we must approve. That's why it's so special to be a member of this committee. That's why you have to be consistent and prioritize this committee above all other committees. Because if you can't assist the office in setting the rules of the game, when people out there complain that, hey, the Auditor General is unfair, people are going to say, but who does he account to? He accounts to you, you see? And you didn't apply your mind to look at whether what was coming up was fair enough as the representative of the people. But don't panic. Today, my understanding is that we don't have to approve all these things today. You can still go back and think about these things and come in. Now, AG, if I have misrepresented the whole concept and what is due to be done, you will correct me as you continue with your presentation. Thanks for allowing me to interrupt you so rudely.
Thank you, Chair. In fact, it did help because it did put things into a very clear perspective, and we can simply build from that point. And the starting point in building on that is the fact that what we are saying is anchored on what we emphasized during the orientation session and on what we reaffirmed again last week during the strategic, not during the annual report presentation, which is to put emphasis on the fact that we do this work guided by a clear strategic objective. And those clear strategic objectives are meant to reinforce our mandate, which is to strengthen the democracy of this country. And that's what preoccupies our mind every time we have to exercise our duties. It's not just for fun, it's for this primary constitutional purpose and responsibility. And we do that, and I think it's important that we clarify this issue so that it's not thought it's an open-ended mandate. Ours is limited to enabling the oversight, enabling accountability, as well as enabling good governance in the public sector through the work that we are specialists in, which is auditing. And we believe that if we do that well, we will make a contribution in building the confidence of the public on the profile of our democracy in South Africa. So that's where basically we are moving from. And now this budget document, which is a medium-term budget, to ask Chair, why is it not 1 year, why is it not 5 years, why is it 3 years? 3 years is a position that we took to make sure that the budget at least does not stretch too far and run the risk of being irrelevant in terms of our assumptions, which is 5 or 10 years or 20 years. Or too short, being 1 year, to limit our sight on things that are overlapping and multi-year. And 3 years was a happy medium, which also is consistent with, I suppose, what Treasury will do in terms of the outlook of their medium-term perspective. So that's the reason for the 3 years. And in this budget and strategic document, we do believe that it is a document that contains everything that we plan to do and a document against which we measure every step of our execution within the office. And a document, more importantly, that we expect to be used by Parliament in assessing our performance. And therefore, it is a benchmark against which we could be held accountable. That is why it is important that we respect it and abide by it. We have also extended the other purpose of this document to say, in strengthening this democracy, in building this public confidence, within these 3 years or this foreseeable future, what is our primary focus? And our primary focus here is to achieve clean audit reports for government. Because the out, ultimate result of our work that we do is an opinion. And if that opinion points out that there is no satisfaction on our side about the way in which the financial resources of the state have been accounted for, then it becomes a problem. And we have said that the only opinion that will give and inspire public confidence is the one that is leaning consistently and sustainably towards a clean audit report, clean audit opinion. And that's the matter that we're also emphasizing as a primary center of focus, so that the resources that we deploy, the actions that we take, have got to be channeled towards that primary objective. By the auditors in the office, by the other support teams within the office, we all have got that as our primary site. And as a result,
maybe I can just interject. You know, I have very bad manners. So I'm sure you're getting used to that. Last week, Thursday, the AG called all the chairs of the various committees and presented before them the so-called audit outcome for 2008-2009. And out of those audit outcomes, apparently there's something like five very bad culprits there that report points to, and some very good, five, I can't remember the numbers. Now, when the Auditor General says that the purpose, the ultimate objective, is to achieve a state where you can have clean audit reports across government, it is at that point when he comes to present to Parliament and say, these are my findings for the outcome of the outgoing financial year. So that's exactly the kind of thing he's referring to there. Those of you who would have followed the news, you would have picked up that the news were very keen. They even, cameras even came to our meeting on Friday. Probably they thought that he's going to be naming and shaming some of those culprits, at least at our meeting, if he didn't do it with the chest. But that's essentially what an example of what he's talking about. All right. Interjecting.
Yes. But it helps to just put things into realism as we go along. And we have therefore Chair decided to stay with the five priorities that we have identified in the previous strategic plan. We have had no reason to revise them or change them, because we still believe that those areas are still relevant to take us to this destination. And therefore, what we presented during the annual report and previously, that we need to continue to have reports that are easily understandable. And for them to be easily understandable, they need to be simple, clear, and relevant. So we still believe that that priority is important, and we need to build on it and perfect it and master it. And throughout the detailed report, the explanations as to what initiatives will be introduced to achieve just that. That's what the document will elaborate on. The second priority, which we feel is still critically important, is the evangelism approach that we take to then go around with these simple reports and talk about them rather than put them on people's desks and hope that they will do something about it. So literature visibility is about that, and that is what has prompted us to do what you have just elaborated upon, engaging with the chairpersons of committees and the roadshows that we have embarking upon in the various provinces to engage with the joint sittings of the executive and the legislatures to share this information and reflect on what it is that will influence clean audit opinions. And incidentally, Chair, we have had an opportunity during this week to also extend our engagement to what was called an extended cabinet sitting on Wednesday, where the President had all the ministers all the premiers and all the ministers of finance in all provinces to reflect on this issue. We're supposed to be there for about just under an hour. We were surprised to walk out of that room after about close to an hour and 45 minutes. That explains the amount of interest and the seriousness that this message was received and taken in that forum.
I think that's very important, because what we have insisted as Parliament is that it's not good enough for us to be seen as the overseers of departments at end of the day. Because once COPA has dealt with the issues, resolutions are adopted by the House that say that these are the wrong things that have happened in departments that need to be fixed. Who must fix them? The people who must fix them are the people who are in charge of those departments. And who are they? That's with the minister concerned in their department. You must go back and see who needs to be interrogated about certain things that went wrong. So I think that engagement is what is very critical, you know, to complete the cycle. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chair.
Yes, oh. Yes, Mr.
Chair, sorry to disturb the chair. Can I just ask one question arising out of
yes.
the presentation to the chairs?
Yes.
Because some of us were present from SCOPA.
Yes.
I mean, there was a lot of pressure on the Auditor General to name the five departments. But I think if Chairman went and read the annual reports, they would have found that kind of information they were looking for. So I don't know why there was unnecessary pressure being put on the AG. Because all of us who read the annual reports of departments will see what the auditor's opinion is. And you'd see, you know, what it was. So I really couldn't understand the incessant pressure to name and shame right there. Thanks.
We did at SCOWEC comment on that issue last Friday, just the day after the thing happened. But unfortunately, I never got an opportunity to actually react there at that chairperson's meeting. But in short, what the AG's argument was is that it's not up to him to name and shame people, that is to dress down people on a public platform, a podium, to say you and you and you and you are the culprits that must be dealt with. His is to present a report, the key outcomes, summarize them, and basically, you know, the full report is tabled, and the full report speaks for itself. You will find out from the report itself who the culprits are. He says, it's not my job to go and dress down people. Now, some of the chairs were insisting that, well, in our view, actually, it's your job to name and shame them, and we actually want you to name and shame them now, you know. So that was the tension that developed there, and hopefully going forward, we'll find a way around that. Obviously, these are some of the issues that will need to be sorted out. My personal view, and I said this to the AG, even on our very first informal meeting soon after we were sworn in, soon after the partying of the new parliament and so on. And that was, you see, with the budget, there is a minister. In this case, he's now called Minister Pravin Gordhan. He comes to the house, there's flowers, there's trees inside the house, and so on. It's a big day, and so on. And he presents the budget speech. All right? This is the money we're going to spend. All right? Then at the end of the financial year, when the Auditor General has checked how that money has been spent, there's no other minister who stands before the house and says, these are the official outcome in terms of how money was spent. Now, that's where the gap is. Because if there was such a minister, he would then be able to stand and say, these are the political issues, you know, give a political presentation. So we need to find a way to say, how do we elevate the Auditor General's report on the public platform of Parliament? And I think going forward in the transformation of Parliament, clear, some ideas might come up. But that's just in relation to that issue. All right, colleagues, unless somebody else wants to react to any of the stuff that arose thus far, let's allow the AG to proceed with this presentation.
Thanks, Chair. The other initiatives relating to the leadership visibility will be explored as part of the detailed presentation as well. But I just needed to highlight the principle around it and why it is important to engage with our simple and clear and relevant reports or messages in our reports. The other issue, Chair, that we have decided to stay with is the fact that we still continue to be an institutional profile is dependent on professionals to do our work, and therefore human resource strategies still remains an important priority, which we need to comment on and make sure that it is applied meaningfully. And in this respect, we still have put a lot of reliance on the strength of the training accounting scheme as the main reservoir for our human resource strength and leadership strength. So it's still something that is relevant for us, and the initiatives being planned and resources expected to be deployed to achieve this will also be dealt with as part of the detailed presentation as well. With regard to the funding model, we will still need to be, like any other business, have a financial perspective to the way we do things. And in this respect, we still believe that it needs to be sustainable, it needs to be focused on margins that are reasonable and achievable, and also the cash flows that are adequate to finance our regular day-to-day obligations. So that is the one that let me restate that these are the two areas which we believe should be optimally dealt with and achieved insofar as the funding model is concerned. And when you go through the details, you will also see the key assumptions that underpin some of these the funding model that will eventually bubble up to the tariffs that we have proposed for SCOEX approval. But that's broadly in terms of this one, which will also be dealt with in detail. Our budget has been in the region of about 1.5 billion. It has grown, in the previous years. It has grown in this year that we are currently in to about 1.7 billion. Is expected to grow by about 7% year-on-year up to 2013. Yeah. So it would eventually hit about 2 billion in that year, but it's a modest 7% growth year-on-year that we have assumed in the budget. But the details and the reasons and the assumptions that underpin that particular broad assumption will also be explored as part of this chapter of our presentation. And the last area is an important area where we still believe that leading by example is something that is a mandatory for us. It's not optional. And therefore, the two areas of convergence in terms of leading by example is having done everything we do from auditing to administering the support structures, etc., we need to make sure that our ability to manage risks and our ability to deal with, to mitigate the risks that will undermine our mandate is what we need to do to perfection. And we should lead by example in that respect, because that's where everything converges. The detail will always chop and change, but if we can master the art of identifying where the risks are and dealing with them before they hit you, your business will always thrive. That's one area that we've done. And the other area that we've identified as important here, which is a national imperative, given the stage of development in the country, is the issue of transformation. both within the office in terms of our own staff and broadly within the profession in terms of the accounting and auditing scheme. But I guess also broadly in terms of the other service providers that we use to make sure that they also live up to the national imperative of transformation and redressing the previous ills that have deprived other people. So, Chair, all in all, about reaffirming that we're still where we were in terms of our areas of priority and areas of importance, all of which we believe will take us quite far in realizing our vision of having a workable relationship that is admired by all our stakeholders. So that's basically, in a nutshell, what is covered in the statement of commitment and policy that I've put in the strategic document, Chair. Then the detail around how all this will be made to happen and the initiatives that will make it to happen is what we'll go through as part of the detailed slide presentation, which is an extract of the contents of this detailed document in front of us. Unless there are perhaps broad questions around those broad principles, Chair, yeah. Then we can launch into the detailed presentation.
I think what the AG is saying to us, if I understand him correctly, is that what he presented to us last week when he was presenting the annual report, where he started off by outlining the key five principles that inform everything they do. He's saying that he believes that those key five principles as key objectives, guiding principles that inform everything they do, is still relevant even in relation to this strategic plan. That is going forward. Those are the key principles that they believe should inform their work. So I don't know whether he's inviting us to reflect on this at this point in time and interrogate that conviction, assumption, whatever you call it. If you have any questions of clarity in that regard or comments at this point in time. Yes, AJ?
You are absolutely right, Chair. I think it's important that before we even move further, we just confirm that there's nothing that we are missing in terms of perhaps the outlook that SCOET as a new outfit would like us to perhaps pay attention to. But in our understanding of what's flying ahead of us, we still believe that these are the issues that are of critical importance to pay attention to. We just want to make sure that we eliminate any blind spots that we may have been suffering from.
The Honourable Steele wants to react at this point.
Thanks, Chair. As I understand it, our constitutional mandate, and also as by the PAA, is not only to have oversight, but essentially to support the AG's office in their independence and their effectiveness. Now, I understand that when the AG talks about leading by example, that is where he is talking, I suspect, to the effectiveness and the credibility of the audit outcomes. But I don't see any reference to the sustained independence of the office. And I'm just wondering whether that's an oversight, a deliberate omission. Should it be somewhere on the front page of the documents, shall we say? It's just, I expected to see it there and it wasn't there.
Because maybe some questions may be related. Mr. Singh?
Thank you, Chairperson. Yeah, one cannot but agree with the broad principles that the AG has so adequately stated here as a way forward in the workings of the Office of the AG. However, from what he said and when we look at the presentation, I just get a sense that the Office of the AG is being a bit modest in underplaying its targets and its reach, particularly with things like stakeholder satisfaction and some of the other areas. But we will look at that as we go on. Because I think you can and are doing much better than your 70 and 80% that you are putting in as targets here in some of the years. But I think in broadly the principles that the AG has enshrined are ones that certainly I and my party can subscribe to. Thanks.
All right. Honorable Zerbe.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I just want to be sure I'm under clarity. Maybe I'm out of order, Chair. Call me in order.
No, you're most welcome.
Okay.
Please go ahead.
But on the issue of the simplicity, clarity, and relevancy of the report, I just want to check with the AG that I don't know if it's my lack of understanding or what, but the AG's report, does it take into account when they are dealing with this opinion? Before they come to this opinion, well, they're using all the reports, or in particular at the local level, at the local municipalities. The actual job done by departments, for example, I'll give you an example of allegations at the Bujanala District Municipality, that you'll be told that there are so many videos have been issued for cleaning the graves of a bridge. You go to actual statements, there's a record there. You go to their books, there are records there. When you look on all those papers they presented before you, you'll be assured that no, really, this work has been done. But you go to the actual places, nothing has been done. Those things are not visible. There's no bridge. Graves are not cleaned. Does your audit or your opinion also cover some of those issues? Because when you check, you also check the statement, the figure there. Do you also apply your mind thoroughly that these are the actual figures, that there is a loaf of bread is R899. That is really what was paid for.
In fact, somebody once said that in this day and age of technology, there's what they call GPS or something, where you can literally zoom into an area sitting in your office and actually check if they say they built 500 houses. You could literally see them as they're presenting, whether those houses are still standing, and possibly even be able to see the cracks if there are any. Without having to physically go there. You could literally see the people walking around in real time. Mr. Singh, you also want to come in?
Sorry, Chair, there's a point that I omitted in terms of the broad working of the Office of the AG.
Yes.
And that is the relationship between the Office of the AG and Treasury. Mm-hmm. Because in many instances, we find that officials at municipal level and even at provincial level are not empowered to do the kind of work that will allow the AG to come in there and express an opinion that is satisfactory. And that is because of a lack of understanding of the roles and responsibilities. Now, I know Treasury says that they have monies to empower, to educate, to have short courses. But I'm just looking at a more intimate, in the way that I express it, intimate administrative relationship between the Office of the AG and Treasury, so that people on the ground know what to do. Because sometimes, you come up with these audit reports, but, it's because of a lack of understanding and knowledge on the ground. That's one. The second thing is, arising out of the other meeting, that the chairman's meeting, the AG did say that before they come up with a final report, they assist departments and ask questions and do all sorts of things. Now, how does that happen? Because you go in, you see what happens, you look at the financial statements. do you then amend your report of, after your management letters are addressed? I just wanted to get some clarity on that.
All right. Honorable Sosiba.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you. I would like to get clarity on the facts for the AAAT, because I understand them. It doesn't get the budget from the Treasury. He has to generate and accumulate his own funds. What I would like to know is that there are many municipalities that have no money to pay. If they don't have money after doing the work, what then?
How do they charge them? All right. Further questions? Now, yes, Mr. Rio, want another bite?
In addition to all what the
speak to your mic.
But I guess not sure. I'm saying it's just an addition on what...
It's also for recording purposes, so...
It's just an addition on what Mr. Singh was saying, AG. You know, on communications committee, when you enter again your report in connection to SABC, we struggled with the understanding of the word capacity. I want, in your own words, in your own opinion, what do you understand by the word capacity? Because it seems like every time when a job is not done, we hide behind the word capacity. Is it lack of skill? Is it just sitting there, does it not want to do his job? What is it, this capacity?
Or is it a diplomatic way of saying to those that are ultimately in charge of the municipality concerned that they lack leadership skills to actually run things in such a way that they are not able to hire the right people who have the capacity to do the work? That's what some people have also charged. But from my side, the one thing is I was trying to find where the vision and mission that we have dealt with extensively when we're looking at the annual report is located in the strategic plan document. I must say that even with the enlarged version of the strategic plan, the proposed blue book, I was trying to find, you know, the print is so small nevertheless. So I just needed to be guided where exactly it's located. Where is it? Page 6. All right. I shall find, because I would expect it to be right up front, even before we talk about your key achievements, well, your key principles. Ms. Take?
Thank you, Chief. May I make a
Honorable Take, sorry.
No, Ms. Take is fine. I'm not sure.
You see, this second truth are misleading me here and making me to make political blunders. Like not addressing Dr. George appropriately. Blame it all on the official, Dr. George.
May I make a suggestion that we let the AG present the report and then we interrogate it afterwards?
Yeah.
Because I'm actually looking at the issue of time.
This first part is the most strategic, because everything else that's going to be said is hinged upon this first part. So that's why it was important that we pause and reflect on this one, because the rest of it will be a lot easier once we are clear on this. But I agree some of the issues are more relating to detail
and in its response he would be able to sift and say, this one will respond in the course of the presentation. But that's fine. All right. It looks like those are the full suite of hands that I've received. AG, it's your turn.
Thank you, Chair. I think the questions do relate to the priorities that we've identified, and my response is to would be to link them to these any one of these five priorities. But the only one that is clearly not directly linked but implied is the first question around the reference to the independence issue. The issue of independence is clearly articulated in the Constitution. We felt it not necessary really to rehash it here because it's there, it's stable, it's unshakable. Unless there is a risk to it being threatened, then perhaps. But I think that's the role more of COWAC. Ours is to do our job in a manner that is living up to that principle, that constitutional principle. The vision and mission as well.
React there and say that, of course, if we were to come up with our own strategic plan, it one of the key objectives of our strategic plan would be to ensure, to promote at least, the independence of the AG's office. Because that's about the threats that come from outside rather than what they from inside are expected to do. All right, proceed.
And therefore, Chair, the vision and the mission that and the values that we have put in page 6 are moving from that, what's the right word for this, conceptual framework that we're operating within an independent and unhindered and objective platform. Yeah. And so are all these five priorities that we have articulated here. The issue around the relationship with Treasury, audit coverage, meaning of capacity, the audit process, and how we deal with the management letter, whether we change things or not. And they're all part of the process that we get involved in as part of our leadership visibility. Because it's through that we're able to respond to all these issues. It's through that, for instance, where we will, in our approach to auditing, we will not seek to look at everything that departments and municipalities do, but we'll seek to look at whether the systems within which things are done can guarantee that proper governance is in sight as the end is in place. And as an incidental way to establishing that, we will then pick up specific incidents that point that certain transactions were not incurred in a manner that is valid, etc., etc. But our analysis of the system that is in place will tell us that. And that is why in our engagement with the stakeholders this time around, we have specifically and deliberately quantified those shortcomings in the system that will give rise to all the incidents that are known, sometimes not even known, but sometimes are suspected to be in existence. And therefore we will tend not to be in a position to guarantee that we can pick up everything, but I can guarantee that we'll pick up the strength or otherwise of the system that will prevent those things from happening. And therefore, in this respect, if you look at any municipality or any department that has got those particular occurrences, the one thing I can guarantee will pick up is that would have raised issues about the strength of their systems to prevent those things from occurring. And therefore, when engaged in leadership, and say fix these issues so that these things that people suspect, these people that people have observed and identified, cease to become a regular occurrence within the government. So that's our approach to things. Because we can never be and we're unable to act on these issues. People that are employed to act are those charged with governance, which is the executive authorities as well as the oversight. And that's why we put emphasis in talking to them to fix these issues. Including the issue of capacity, by the way, which, however way it's defined, but it basically means it's inability to do your work. Reasons can be varied. They can be because people are do not have the resources, or people that have got resources but are not doing what they're supposed to do. But it's got that broad meaning, essentially. But our standpoint on that is always where it exists, there's always someone who's employed to deal with the capacity issue. So there can never be an instance where that can be made an excuse. Not in any institution, because that's what the role of the leadership is, and that's why we are quite firm in engaging the top most leadership in the country to make sure that these issues do not left unattended and unexposed to them. Because if you do that, then we make sure that anyone below that level is made to perform in a manner that will take us in the right direction. Now, let me just talk specifically with the relationship with leadership with Treasury, which is also part of this leadership visibility thing as well. And out of that, there's quarterly sessions that we have with Treasury, which meant to streamline the consistency with which we interpret guidance and instructions to government, so that we don't come there and audit things in a manner that is understood differently from what Treasury has instructed. And with that, we have had, great successes in closing the gaps that have existed in the past that caused conflicts during the course of the audit. And in this day and age, there is almost a guaranteed consistency in the messages that the Accountant General and the Audit Office articulate out there around issues. The strength of this, in fact, has emerged even in the last few engagements this week, where in our emphasis, I'm just making this as an example, in our emphasis of the role of the audit committees, their structuring, their positioning, the role of the CFOs, their structuring and their expected deliverables. With Treasury, we will be now considering putting together a proposed, Praveen calls, Minister of Finance, calls it a handbook that is clear, that is simple, as a guide to say this is at the minimum responsibility you have as a minister. If you've done and ticked these, nothing is likely to go wrong. Nothing is likely to escape you and prevent you from being able to fulfill your executive authority responsibility, which is currently the case at the moment. So those are some of the benefits of this leadership visibility and engagement. That's what we're busy with. Okay. For the funding for struggling municipalities, that one we're dealing with, incidentally, is part of this leadership visibility stuff as well, because when municipalities do struggle to pay us, we have elevated this information to the relevant executive authorities within the municipalities, in the provincial legislatures, for provincial sphere, as well as national sphere, to the extent that even the Minister of Cooperative Governance is involved in this particular aspect for the three provinces where we have got struggling municipalities. But what if even done was to extend this analysis to identify what is the reason for municipalities to be struggling. Because for us, in terms of our funding model, it's impacting on our cash flows. And when we discover that these municipalities are technically insolvent or bankrupt, it's an indication that it's not that they are being mischievous, but they physically and they're just unable to pay because of their financial status. And therefore, someone ought to come and assist them or bail them out or whatever. So that's the extended analysis that you do in monitoring this information. But someone has got to pay because government has got money. And in our posture around this matter is that it's impossible for government to have a going concern problem because unless I think it would be something unusual for government to go under or any entity of government to go under. So the elevation is what we will seek to do in this instance. Yeah. Honourable Singh, I forgot your other question, your first question. When you came with the second question, the other one went out of the window.
The one was on the management
letters. The one before that one, yeah.
Okay. The one was you underplaying your ability to actually engage. You're doing a lot more than your target suggests. Was it that one?
It was linked to that, but there was a specific question prior to that.
It was a Treasury AG relationship. Then how do you assist municipalities in coming up with your final report?
No,
and then you're underplaying your targets don't suggest that you are doing as well as we know you are doing.
Yeah. No, that one would defer to the detailed discussion.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. I think you have covered most of the questions, yeah. Maybe let me just respond on the... I know I've responded very vaguely on the audit process in terms of what we do with responses on the management report. The audit process is meant to identify, plan, once we go to the field, identify the issues. Once we've identified the issues, identify the reason thereof or the root thereof, and then give that information to the government officials to confirm whether our findings are consistent with their understanding. If it is so, then we carry that particular finding. But if they give us additional information that clarifies the matter differently or changes our initial findings because of new information, we do change the management report. And that's the reason for consulting, because sometimes you get information from another official, but perhaps the senior would have a different set of information. So before we finalize everything, we make sure that every layer and level within the organization has, up to the head of department, has had an opportunity to comment on our management report. Once it's watertight, then it gets translated into the audit report, where we sift only those issues that really matter, that will impact on our opinion, or those that we feel need to be emphasized, or the third aspect of our report, those that we feel should be mentioned because they are eroding the governance effectiveness and internal control effectiveness of the department. And all these things that are raised on other matters emerge from a selection of matters that we believe are serious because of their nature, out of the management report, which has been thoroughly consulted and confirmed of its accuracy with all the officials up to the head of department. So that's the process that we follow.
Yeah. Can I also just react to two questions that were raised earlier by colleagues? The one question is, what do you do with the problem of municipalities failing to pay for the services rendered to them by the AG's office of doing audits? Now, apparently there are various reasons for that. One of the reasons is that municipalities are just not generating enough revenue to afford the cost of having proper audits being done on their books. Now, one of the suggestions to cure that problem that's been put forward is that in the budgeting system, a provision should be made, budgeting system for government institutions, provision should be made specifically for audit fees as an item on the budget, and to make sure that those fees, that item, is always ring fenced. The money will not go to other things. It will stay there for that people, you know, as one way. I just wanted to say in that regard also that I was supposed to be attending another meeting now at 10:30, where a parliament has set up a task team to look at how parliament processes the budget proposals from the executive under the new money bills amendment something act. Because that new act is going to, for the first time, allow Parliament to be able to look at the budget that the Minister of Finance is presenting to Parliament and say, do we want to amend this budget or not? So in those engagements, it should be possible for us as Parliament to say, but have you proposed this thing? And obviously, as SCOAC, if we're allowed to make a comment in that process, we would say, but we don't see the item on the audit fee. Where is it, you know? All right. So that is basically the responses. And I just wanted to say, insofar as the question from Honorable Zebe is raised, to say, how does it happen that we get these glossy reports that say houses have been built, graves have been cleaned, or whatever, but when you go there, you find that the situation on the ground is nothing different. All right. Now, I am not sure where the AG's role starts and stops, where the role of the legislature or the councillors in the municipalities in terms of their oversight responsibility, or us in Parliament as a portfolio committee concerned, whether it's health and so on and has to do with hospitals, where our oversight responsibility starts and ends, you know. But it's something about for oversight that we need to resolve. And, of course, now we have Minister Collins Chabane, who now has to oversee government performance in terms of monitoring evaluation. Now, that is a new role there as well. So this different areas where oversight is located need to find synergy, so that if we're looking figures on the one hand, we're looking glossy reports on the other hand, we're also able at the same time to look at what courts and lawyers would say, who does the in-local inspection, the actual situation on the ground, looking at what has happened, which has not happened. So I think that is a critical issue that we must flag and see where we take it forward, whether at the level of the chairperson's forum or transformation, the oversight model of Parliament, somewhere, we cannot afford to lose that point. And I'm glad that you raised it so sharply. Honorable Zebe.
You know, I was asking this question, DG, because when you are a member of parliament, you are down there, you are doing your constituency work. Some of these questions we are faced with, and we are not expertise in some of this field. Because my findings, where I come from, when I'm going as a member of parliament, is that the mayors are hiding behind AG's report when they are questioned. Now, the integrity of the AG's office is questioned by an ordinary citizen that does not know the role, that does not understand clearly the role of the AG's office. That when a mayor is called question to just say, no, my municipality is clean, I can refer to the AG's report. In the eyes of the community, once the mayor is responding, saying that, you say, okay, that means there's a relationship between this mayor and the AG's office. And bear in your mind that in those communities, the rural areas, when you refer to the AG, they don't refer to AG's office. They refer to Mr. Nombembe. Now this Mr. Nombembe, because we know that this mayor is corrupt, that means Mr. Nombembe is part of this corruption. That is why he's not exposing some of these issues. They don't understand that if money was spent according to the report, but in terms of the service delivery, nothing was produced, they can't understand why it doesn't reflect in your report, according to what I said in some of the meetings. So my recommendation would be, I know that you have embarked on a lot of roadshows. Maybe also the impact of those roadshows. What kind of people do you meet when you are doing roadshows? I also recommend that maybe in your tight schedule, if we can squeeze the rural areas, the traditional leaders, so that they must be able to engage in your report. Because really, it's
maybe you shouldn't say squeeze. You should say prioritize.
Prioritize. I use road squeeze, prioritize. Because really, from what I heard in the meeting that I attended, really, some people feel that the Auditor General is a friend to some of the mayors. That is why some of the things are not coming out. And it's part of this infighting in our municipalities. We see them every day on TV. People are saying they just have those reports. But when you go to the AG's report, nothing is reflected there. And the mayor will tell them, no, this is my report. This report is quite untested. Where do you get that? That's why, really, I was asking this question, Honorable Chair. I'm representing my constituents.
And you're doing it very well. We want that to happen. Actually, it talks to one of the priority areas or principles: simplicity, clarity, and relevance. Or which one? Visibility of our leadership. One of those priorities, because the integrity of the office is absolutely critical. And public perception is key to that integrity. Anything, whether, by the way, in politics, perceptions are facts. There is no distinction between perceptions and facts, because it's those perceptions that makes you win or lose votes. It's not the facts that make you win or lose votes. So it is very critical. It's a very critical point. So we need to locate some of those issues properly, contextualize them properly, and look at how best we deal with them. Because our role also is to protect the independence and integrity of the office as well. That's why I said, let's flag this thing also, over and above the AG responding to it, so that within the system of governance, we can look at it in terms of whose role. That's why I say, whose role is it to do what? Because maybe our role as the oversight mechanism is to, having received the AG's report, is to go and look on the ground and come with our own report and then give feedback somehow. So we shouldn't exclude our own role as well. All right. AG?
Yes, I think that is very, in fact, this is very useful feedback. And the reason I'm saying that is because we should take great exception to leaders that deliberately mislead the public. Because those leaders, those mayors, those executive mayors understand what a clean report is. They understand our classification that unless we have got no concerns about internal controls, you cannot regard yourself to have a clean report. And to hide behind those reports of ours and mislead vulnerable people should be taken with a grave misconduct. You know.
Like it's borders on fraud, actually.
It's actually fraud, actually. It is. And that's why we take the trouble to engage with the mayors directly, so that they understand our concerns. And in all our roadshows, I've been to each and every district. In fact, I've engaged with almost every mayor in the country through the district gathering, including Bushanala. They know exactly that no report in the Northwest can be deemed to be a clean report. They know exactly what our concerns are. In fact, it's a province where, as we speak now, no reports have been tabled as we speak today for auditing. That's why the Ministry of Finance is having a serious talk with all the mayors. You would have done that yesterday because of that issue. There are serious vulnerabilities in their effectiveness in managing those municipalities. We have spoken, for instance, about at national level, on average, about 40% of the departments that are unable to produce evidence of their service delivery utterances in their annual reports. I would not be surprised if that figure would be even higher in municipalities. And that's the extent to which departments are not having institutionalized systems to demonstrate and dispel some of the perceptions and experiences of the members of the public. So that's the starting point, Shay, in terms of taking exception to leaders that deliberately mislead the public using our reports. But secondly, one of our leadership visibility thing here is to engage with the civil society structure. And I must admit that we haven't gotten around to getting to that level. So the suggestion to engage with traditional leaders, for instance, and many other civil society structures is something that we're still working towards. And at the point we're able to do that, it will then help to neutralize some of these misstatements, so to speak, here. But it's something that is in the pipeline.
All right. I think we will have to see as we go along how to improve the synergy between the different role players who collectively have to discharge the oversight function. It's not an issue that I think we can exhaust in one day. APEC set had a conference. These issues were discussed extensively. Some resolutions were adopted. Those of us who attended that conference, you will recall what happened there. But obviously, we will have to continue to soldier on and fight this battle at whatever level where we have an opportunity to do that. These are very important matters. But let's in the interest of progress, move on.
Thanks, Chair. Just probably just wanted to highlight one or two things before I get into the detail of the presentation. The question that was raised earlier regarding the role of the committee with respect to the session and the issue that we're dealing with today is contained in Section 38 of the Public Audit Act, which is articulating clearly what is expected of us and what is expected to be done by the committee. And maybe another reference which has authority in the Public Audit Act is also in respect of the matter pertaining to defaulting on payment of audit fees to the Auditor General. And just for members of reference, that is contained in Section 23.5 of the Public Audit Act. And just enough now for making reference to the Act, just in case I get asked to interpret some of the stuff that's sitting there. And clearly, as an accountant, mine is really to understand what the intention of the legislator is in respect of this. But just quickly, in terms of our focus for the strategic plan and the budget, I've also noted that the broad mandate in terms of the constitutional responsibility of the office is also captured in Section 4 of the Public Audit Act, specifically Section 4.1, which says that we must audit and report. And therefore, the approach that we have taken as an office in developing what I'm about to engage with in terms of the strategic plan and the budget is largely informed by that constitutional mandate for us to audit and to report. And to just perhaps close the gap on the issues that the AG raised in respect of the five areas of commitment, certainly when we talk about the simplicity, relevance of the message in Chapter 1 of what is presented in the strategic plan document, it is largely about what is expected of us in terms of Section 4.1, to audit and to report. And in order to do that, obviously, we have identified that we need to engage with quite a number of stakeholders who have a constitutional task to do something about what comes out of our reports, which also, from our priority areas of focus, is what is captured in the visibility of leadership. And in order to do that, we think it is also important to share with the committee how are we going to get the people, what type of people are these that we're looking for to carry out this mandate. Are they the kind of people that are independent in fact and in appearance? And I think I'm also going to talk about the number of efforts that we are going to be focusing on and initiatives to ensure that when somebody sets foot at the Auditor General, whether they are in the Northwest, whether they are in Mpumalanga, they are the type of people who are well-positioned to assist the office to carry out its mandate as articulated in the Public Audit Act. And also, I'm going to quickly go through at a high level on the resourcing to assess whether the office will, at any one time, as it pursues its mandate, will it have the necessary resources to attract the right type of people? Will it have the resources to provide accommodation and various other tools that are required to carry out this mandate? And also, lastly, to deal with the issue of how does this whole office conduct itself as an institution so that it can be able to live up to the reputation promise that it has set itself, which is to strengthen the country's democracy by enabling oversight, accountability, and governance in the public sector. I'm going to talk about those broad themes. And as we said earlier, when we engaged last week on the annual report, it was about what it is that we have achieved up to the end of March 2009. And we're obviously going to draw from those past achievements, and also we're going to flag some of the obstacles and challenges that we continue to face as we implement this strategic plan, and in fact, as any organization implements any strategic plan. And we're going to identify very clearly what we believe are the initiatives that are going to assist us to cross over those obstacles so that at least we can get closer, ultimately, to achieving this broad vision, what we refer to as our reputation promise. Before I get into the detail of this, this document that we have in front of us is a product of a number of engagements within the office of the AG, both at head office as well as input that has come from various players, those that face directly with the auditees, the people that produce the audit reports that we table, the trainee accountants right up to the business executives who run our various offices have given input to this based on what they believe are the things that will assist us to move forward. And they've also considered issues of the resources that they need to be able to be in a position to execute this mandate. So there was a process which has now ultimately got to a point where all of us in the office have agreed that this is how we want to march forward. As I indicated earlier, IG has already spoken to the issue of the overall commitment, I'm going to build onto those just by identifying some of the typical challenges that we will deal with in respect of each one of those chapters. We'll then share with the committee the detailed budget, which is contained in the principal document, the one dated 30 September, which is our strategic plan and budget document. And thereafter, there will be two issues that are also expected of us in terms of what's in Section 38, and that is the consideration of the tariffs for audit, as well as how do we put this game plan of auditing in place so that we can ensure that even matters that were raised, among other things, by Honorable Seder regarding matters of physical inspection stroke verification. I think those ones will probably substantially be captured under that audit directive, because the audit directive is articulating a very clear authority in terms of how we go about doing our audits. Says that we do our audits in accordance with the international standards of auditing, among which are specific standards of how you execute an audit. So I hope that by the time we get to the audit directive, we'll provide clarity about the fact that not only are the inspection of records the only procedure that we perform, but there are a number of other procedures to ensure that you have a better chance of understanding whether a bridge does exist where it is claimed to have been built. So we will deal with that under the area of the audit directive. If I may launch directly, or the AGF dealt with this already, so I'm going to skip the overview of the commitment. If I launch straight into the more core area of our audits, we plan going forward to the year 2010, beginning April 2010, which is the period covered by this plan, covering the period beginning 1 April 2010 going forward. And in that period, when we have engaged with the committee and agreed on whether this is the way to go forward, we will continue to do what we refer to as the root cause analysis, so that we can best position for the users of the audit reports that we issue what are the key issues that they need to be paying particular attention to, with a view to ensuring that the dream of having clean audits becomes a reality. And we have also committed as an office overall to ensure that the messages and the manner in which we report on issues identified during audits are highlighted and clearly articulated as simply as we can. And we believe that this is an ongoing process. If you reflect back, a number of our initiatives over time as an audit office have largely been limited to doing an audit and reporting on it. And a number of our people are experiencing a new reality where they now need to analyze what is contained in their report. And I believe that we are doing a lot more than what an ordinary audit firm does. An audit firm would normally do an audit, conclude on it, report on it, and perhaps follow up after 8 months for the following year's audit without having gone to the deeper analysis of what it is that needs to be identified as a core theme in the audit report. And I think having been in the space in the private sector, this is an area, I think, of speciality, which even other areas in the auditing field have come to embrace. So that will be an area, Chair, that we will do, so that we don't leave on the table an audit report that is positioned in a technical language that is not understood to the people who are supposed to make a difference around it. The other area we have highlighted quite clearly in our annual report is the area of timeliness and quality. And these are two important features that we put in our threat plan. Because on the quality side, we want to have a reasonable level of assurance that we are not communicating matters on an audit which could come back to be questioned because they do not stack up to the quality requirement. On the issue of timeliness, again, this is an area which we pay specific attention to because it enables all of the levels of government, all the three spheres of government, to put on the table what it is that they've done with their resources closer to the time that they've spent that money, so that we are not engaging from an oversight perspective on audit matters that are 5 years old. We think that the timeliness issue, if everybody is required to table an annual report within months of the end of the financial year, we want to get out of a situation where we have to wait for these reports as if it was not known that they need to be pushing this. And this is driven largely, among others, also by our ongoing visibility and stakeholder engagement. That is the core in terms of the statutory audits, in terms of the financial audits that we do, where we express an opinion on financial statements. We will continue to focus on these areas, and that's why AG indicated earlier that we have not departed from any of those core themes. And I think substantially the elements of those themes, of those key themes, still remain. And for us, insofar as the regularity of financial audit is concerned, it is about drilling down to the root cause analysis and ensuring that the information that we provide and produce is of a level of quality that matches the international quality control standards, among others. And also that the information that is presented is timely so that the relevant current decisions can be made. We do not want to be in a situation where we've reported something that related to a law that existed 2 years ago, and when we interact with it, we realize that in fact that law was scrapped 18 months ago. Therefore, the matter that you have in your report may no longer be relevant. And that's why I think the issue of timeliness becomes critical. The audit of performance information. We have interacted with quite a number of departments over the period post the finalization of our reports, and we have identified that across a number of areas, both national and provincial departments, constitutional institutions and trading entities, and we are picking this up as we are going forward in the process of the roadshow, but there are issues of readiness with regard to the work that we need to do around the audit of performance information. Over the past, what we have been doing has been doing the audit of performance information to check whether the information that is contained in the annual reports is it the type of information that can be relied upon, in the sense that if the Department of Housing, as an example, puts in its annual report that it has built and delivered 150,000 houses, is there a system where that information gets captured from wherever that house has been delivered to a point where the integrity of that information when it is produced in a system that's housing can be relied upon, in the sense that nobody can go into it and interfere with it and change it because there are certain program controls that are not working in the environment. So that's what we've been doing over time. What we now positioned and gearing ourselves to do going forward is now to put an opinion to that audit of performance information. In the past, we have not done it, and we've been in a process of phasing in the issuing of an opinion on this. And as I say, we've now decided that we are going to slightly delay the expressing of an opinion. Initially, that opinion was meant to be expressed for the years ending March 2010, which is the current financial year that we are on now. And so we've given ourselves a little bit of leeway to say maybe we need to consider the challenges that are there in the environment on matters of readiness, on matters of reliability of what we've seen thus far, so that we can express that opinion perhaps no later than another year and a half or two down the line. But we're engaging with this, and we're raising the profile of the importance of the audit of performance information with all our auditees, and all of them are gearing up for this. And we are insisting that this is not a delay to get them to relax and think that there's another year coming. We want to put the best foot on the accelerator so that we can make sure that come the day when you express this opinion, nobody can say, I did not know what your expectations were with respect to this information. So that will be an area that we will be focusing on, so that the service delivery goals that are put in strategic plans of departments as portfolio committees engage with them. At least portfolio committees can look at those quantitative outcomes in the same way that they look at the financial information, because it will be accompanied by an opinion going forward. And then the last bit is an area we were hard pressed over time to put our best foot on, and this is the area of performance auditing. Over time, we've looked at a number of infrastructure audits, we've looked at various interventions, but we haven't really gone flat out on the area of performance auditing. We've then said, in order for us to have the necessary traction when it comes to performance auditing, and by the way, this area, the difference between it and audit of performance information, this is where we reflect on the three E's of performance, which is the economy with which the resources have been acquired, the efficiency with which the resources have been used. If we're building a school and the estimate is that based on the quantity surveyor's input, if the quantity surveyor says that this particular Department of Public Works is going to assist the Department of Education with the construction of a school, and it will take 50,000 bricks to build that school, after the design has been analyzed by technical experts, the efficiency part of this performance auditing is going to be evaluating whether indeed that 50,000 bricks have been used, or have they used 75,000 bricks, for example, to build a school that was meant to be built for 50,000 bricks. So that's the kind of issue that we're going to be focusing on when we evaluate the efficiency, the efficiency with which the input into that production process has been achieved, so that there's no unnecessary waste that goes into some of the projects that are all over the place. And then the last E is to look at the effectiveness. And I guess the effectiveness is probably reflecting, among others, on some of the statements that would be made by leadership and executive. If they have built a school and the school was meant to achieve certain goals that are articulated in education, we will then be interrogating that to assess whether those goals are being achieved, are they getting closer to achieving those goals, and so on. So this will be the area that we are focusing on. And in terms of the topics that we have identified, we looked at a broad area which we refer to as poverty reduction, among others issues within the education environment. We've selected the education area, for example, as an area to focus on. And pretty much not one topic. It could range from the assessment of the effective utilization of the likes of your feeding schemes, for example, programs that are going into schools, to also apply those three E's to that initiative. So that is the one area we're going to be focusing on, and we're going to do this not just in 1 year, because probably the impact of all of these programs is something that will be better assessed when it is implemented over a period of time. And so far as the public entities are concerned, we've also said that maybe one of the important things to focus on is to look at the way public entities are governed as a sector in government. Are there proper oversight and governance mechanisms that are applied in state-owned enterprises? We're going to be doing a performance audit on this. We've already, beginning of this current parliament, had an engagement with public enterprises. And I know that there was a workshop that was held last week, Friday, to take forward how our approach, which we've already developed, is going to be implemented in that environment. But the essence of this is to say, if a department like communication, and as an example, has under it public entities like Centec and SABC, if that department has got those two entities, normally the department, as a shareholder department, which represents the shareholder interests of the state, if that department has got those two entities, does it have the necessary tools and systems to exercise the required oversight and governance over those entities, so that if there are emerging risks within a particular entity, that the department can react proactively. For example, the relationship between a department and a public entity is governed by a shareholder compact. And one of the things we want to be evaluating here from a performance audit is to say, when the shareholder compact is signed between a department and a public entity, what happens to that compact? Does it get shelved and somebody hopes that nothing goes wrong? Or does the department set up a system in place to make sure that if the entity like SABC or Centec sends their quarterly reports in terms of their performance against their third plan, is there a mechanism in the department to evaluate what are the outcomes that are coming through from that entity, to anticipate what are the potential risks that might confront the department as a shareholder in that entity? And we think about this as a live example of what happened, among others, with Eskom. If one looked at public enterprises and say that when Eskom management and the Eskom board report to the Department of Public Enterprises, does public enterprise, through its shareholder compact, have the ability to engage with the issues that are emerging on the delivery of Eskom so that they can be able to anticipate that there will be a number of resources required to gear up Eskom over the future, as well as if we are likely to have blackouts, for example, over the next 2 to 3 years. Can they see that from an oversight perspective by engaging as a department on this? So that's the area that we want to be engaging on. So it's more a performance audit that is geared at understanding what the department does.
I just want to finish this piece and then I'll allow a brief engagement.
And then the last part in terms of the third focus area, which has already commenced, is also around government department use of consultants. And this is not positioned to create a negative spin on the use of consultants. We are engaging with this topic from a performance auditing point of view to say, before a line function in the department decides that it's going to go and source the services of consultants, let's take an example in the area of finance. If in finance there's a CFO, and all the functions in finance have got people that are there, we want to engage with the question of, did you consider the economy, the effectiveness, and the efficiency of engaging a consultant at the end of the year to come and prepare financial statements for you? Is the option maybe not to deal with the fact that you can't get what you're looking for from the existing people, rather than going to get somebody else to come and do it? And those are the three E's again get addressed there to say, when that consultant has been genuinely engaged, and maybe there's a good reason for engaging them, have you assessed the effectiveness of the output that you are getting from them? So that you don't get to a situation where when we have to go in a department and inquire about the standing of the financial statements that were produced, which is a typical example of what happens in most municipalities, where they will wash their hands of it and say, we've got this done by firm A, B, and C of accountants and auditors. And so we want to evaluate those things to say, yes, fine, there's a space for consultants in the work that government does, but to what extent are there measures from a performance auditing point of view to ensure that this is done properly? Maybe let me pause there, Chair, for questions.
All right. So we're at a high level focus on this, the application of this key principle. I'm going to allow us to pause. Tea will be ready in the next 5 minutes, and use the short time to ask some quick questions, get responses, go for tea, and then we can tackle the next area. Mr. Steele?
Thanks, Chair. I was reminded of the issue when the Deputy AG started talking about Eskom, but my question is broadly within the area of performance audits, and particularly the economy efficiency effectiveness emphasis. When the AG's office goes into an entity, now
as I say, it came to mind when he started using the example of Eskom, but it could apply to local governments, municipalities, provincial departments, entities, whatever. In terms of these three principles, economy, efficiency, and effectiveness, if the AG's office sees or discovers examples with an asset, be it infrastructure, be it equipment, be it whatever, any capital asset, if that is being poorly maintained, it is leading to asset value decay, to the loss of effectiveness of an asset, the loss of economy in terms of the cost of its replacement, would the lack of maintenance of infrastructure be part of that performance audit?
Dr. George? Thank you, Chairperson. On page number 6, there's reference to the clean audit opinions. Now, it might seem obvious, but maybe if you can just clarify a little bit what is actually meant by a clean audit, because my understanding is that you have unqualified, you have unqualified with emphasis of matter, you have qualified, and then you have adverse, and then you have disclaimers. Now, when you're doing an audit, you're actually looking at this various, you're dipping into this pool with a fishing rod in a way, and you're looking at various things, and you're saying, well, yes, whatever you're giving me is an accurate reflection, and you're ticking up all of the boxes. But it is theoretically possible that once an audit is done, that there may well be a problem that was not picked up during the audit. A clean audit suggests that everything is perfectly fine, I think, in the mind of the audience. So if you can maybe just clarify when that term clean is used and why is it used. Thank you.
Mr. Singh?
Thank you, Chair. I think I the area of performance auditing, I see the Office of the AG is proposing that the one of the themes for 2010-2011 should be poverty reduction and in broad terms, and then you want to hone in on education. Since we are doing this for 3 years, should we not look at possibly two other areas of performance auditing, which is the health sector and housing, as areas that the Office of the AG should look at from a performance audit, and not only look at it, but also pronounce well in advance, in a matter of weeks after this is accepted by the committee and everybody else, that it is the intention of the Office of the Auditor General to hone in specifically on performance auditing issues in those three particular arenas, education, housing, and health. Maybe, and I'm saying why make it a public pronouncement, is maybe it will have a salutary effect in that those departments themselves will say, hey, they're going to come after us now. Let us start getting our internal checks in order before the Office of the Auditor General comes in and says, hey, our health system is retrogressing, etc., etc. So I'm just asking for a view on that, on those two other arenas, and making public pronouncements in advance. And then the other one on consultants and effectiveness and leading by example. Now, if we look later on in your financial statements, we'll see Deloitte and Touche. Is it true for Deloitte and Touche or Deloitte or wherever they are? There's a lot of managerial secondments. Okay? Now, how do you marry that in terms of hiring outside people in your own office and other departments now go and get consultants? How do you explain that? How do we explain that to departments? Thanks.
Honorable Machaba.
The Comchair, we're going to talk of use of consultants. Maybe there's this CFO who's using consultants. Is it a capacity? That he has got a capacity, or what would you term it? Somebody who's not prepared to do the work is going to use the consultants. Would you call that the capacity or what?
Right. Honorable Seven. Use the next one. I think we must condemn that mic permanently. Fold it away.
Honorable Chair, on the issue of the state owned enterprises, I think I totally agree with what has been put forward. But what I'm getting in my mind is, after identifying those systems of which I agree, or the weaknesses for oversight purposes, the agent's office obviously will identify and will give his opinion. Will you go the same route? Who is going to implement, or who is going to make sure that whatever has been proposed, or that is an opinion, will be implemented? Or is it going to be the same route that every time after an opinion of the agency office, nothing is done? So I just want to be sure that all this, you know, the agency office has power to make sure that whatever opinion is made will be implemented by the department. Because really, as government, we are lacking in terms of oversight on this entity.
Maybe before they even respond to that one, I need to re-emphasize the point I made earlier. It's in terms of the Constitution. All the public, the Chapter 9, if you read Chapter 9, and that applies to all the Chapter 9 Constitution, essentially their job is to report and to do nothing else. They don't have an army of police or military who will go door-to-door with guns and everything and say, yeah, these are the corrupt guys. Take them out. We want to talk to them. All right? They just report, and that's where their mandate ends. From there, it goes to Parliament. All right? It goes to SCOPA. It goes to the Portfolio Committee. They are charged on behalf of Parliament with the responsibility to call those officials, to even call ministers concerned and ask them questions. All right? Clarify why is the AG saying that you have not accounted for the money that you were given. And let them give you answers as politicians. All right? You adopt resolutions in the House that say, Department A, B, C, D, the AG said 1, 2, 3 about them. We called them, and this was their response. We are not satisfied with their response.
You misunderstood me.
All right.
I'm saying the AG will be saying, these are the systems.
All right.
Will that report be able to say, this is how these systems must be implemented in a form of recommendation?
Right.
Not that if there's that, I know that there is our role to do oversight in an entity, and after the opinion by the AG, we are the ones that have to approve or do something about it. I know that.
All
but
right.
my question to the AG is that it's a good thing that they want to do, that there must be systems in place. But I'm saying, will their report also reflect that these are the systems?
All
and
right.
I propose that this is how it must work.
All right.
Not necessarily that this Chapter 9 institution, if they fail to do their job as an opinion, then they must act. No,
right.
That's not what I'm saying.
All right. No, it's fine. It's fine. But I nevertheless wanted to make emphasis on that point because the issue still arises. After these problems have been identified, why then? Because these problems continue to recur. So I think it's important that we as SCOWEC talk to the issue of enforcement as a matter in its own right. And that's what I was really talking to. But before the AG responds, I want to react to one or two issues that he raised. First, in relation to the governance and accountability of public entities, your parastatal. When I was chairing social development, a proposal was put forward to create a board to which that entity would account. In other words, the governance structure. And there was a debate whether a board is necessary or not, or whether the CEO should simply report directly to the minister. And one of the issues that I raised with the DG was that, you see, DG, ultimately, existing that SASSA is an autonomous body established by statute, reports directly to the minister, and the department has no involvement in it. You mustn't be too excited about it. Because you see, as the Portfolio Committee on Social Development, if something goes wrong with the operations of SASSA, we're not just going to call the CEO of SASSA to come and talk to us. We are going to call you, DG, to also come and talk to us. Because where they say the minister, any reference to the minister in any law must mean the minister assisted or supported by his entire machinery called the department in being able to exercise oversight. And you as DG have to make sure that you support the minister, your minister, in overseeing that entity. All right. So I think this is an issue that needs to be clarified once and for all. Because you find a situation where the department says, no, my hands are tied. It's an independent parastatal. We have no say, you see. They report directly to the minister, you see. But the second issue that arises is where boards have been created to run some of these entities, all right? You find concerns about how critical it is to create a board that stands between the department and the entity, all right? Because in a sense, sometimes it becomes difficult for the department to really oversee what's happening there because there's a board in between. And of course, the cost effectiveness in some instances of utilizing boards and the cost implications. Now, the question I wanted to ask is whether this matters are being engaged with in terms of reviewing of governance structures of service delivery institutions within government, and where these discussions are at. Because it goes to the point of economy, efficiency, and effectiveness. All right. Are there any other questions that anybody wants to raise before we go for tea that they can respond to? Do you want to respond to all these things now, or would you like us to break for tea and come back?
I'm in your hands, Chair, but there's one other bit.
Let's proceed so that when we come back, we can start on it freshly.
Chair, if I may just attempt a couple of the questions, I'll just reinforce the one on the performance audit on state-owned entities. We're not going to express an opinion on that. We're not going to express an opinion. It's going to be a report on factual findings. For example, if we found that there is no shareholder contact between the ministry and the entity, then that will be a statement of fact to say that how do you regulate the governance relationship between the department and the entity where there is no shareholder contact. If issues around the board, for example, and you look at the board and the board does not do what is expected to be done in terms of assessing the broad strategic plan and acting on behalf of the department on matters pertaining to the execution by the executive of that public entity, it will be a statement of fact. So we're not going to say that in our opinion we think that A and B and C in the same way that we do in an audit report. Because in an audit report, that's what we normally do. But in this case, we're going to issue a factual findings report, deliver it to the executive authority. And it's obviously our expectation in the same way that we expect on a normal audit for the executive authority to act on it. Because it will be highlighting to the executive authority what are the type of risks that if they don't manage could translate into serious problems for the entity. So we will be issuing a factual findings report which under normal circumstances we would expect them to act on. On the issue of consultants and what this thing means in relation to capacity. And I don't know if maybe this is just a funny formulation of mine with regard to my understanding of what we normally talk about when we deal with capacity, and I think AG has covered it earlier in the report, in the question that was raised with regard to capacity issues. But I do understand this thing to mean that in relation to consultants, among other things, capacity is a state where the person is not there to do what is expected to be done. Normally, that's a vacancy. Another one is, again, the person is on board, but they cannot do what's expected of them. And that becomes a skills issue. Another one is that the person can do the job, but they know that there's no consequence for doing nothing about the fact that they can do the job. So I think it's not just one element. There's a couple of elements, and that's why it's important that as we go through this issue of evaluating capacity, we look at it specifically. Is it a vacancy? Is it a person who cannot do what's expected of them even though they are employed in the position? Or is this a person who has all that is required at a minimum to do the job? They can do the job, but they know that even if they haven't done it, nobody's going to do anything. I think that becomes then a performance issue for somebody who has the appropriate skill but are not delivering what is expected of them. So I think if we look at the issue of capacity insofar as when and why do people then opt for using consultants, it's because they are not feeling comfortable to deal with those realities. Either they're not going to push hard to go fill a vacancy, or they're not going to counsel somebody who's not performing, or they're going to recognize the fact that there's somebody who's got the skill but it's going to be a challenge to get rid of them. Hence, then the option is then to say, maybe let's go find a firm that's going to do this thing quickly, pay them, and they're out of the system, and it's done.
Do you want to make a follow-up, Honorable Sarah? Yeah? Please go ahead.
I just want to check that as a matter of simplicity of your report, don't you think it will be necessary for you when you do your opinion, per municipality, to say in this municipality, capacity refers to lack of skill. It must not just be a general issue. It must be specific that here we are referring to the skill, here we are referring to that this person is there but is not able to perform his duties. So that it does not be generalized, because I agree with you, it means many things. But in your opinion, can you be specific that in this regard we are referring to this part of capacity? Because
does your report give a set-up
breakdown?
I guess when you look back to the previous slides when we talked about root cause analysis, maybe this is a very useful recommendation for us to take on board, so that when we do the root cause analysis, we then analyze this word capacity. I don't know when it sneaked itself into the dictionary, but it never was there for many years, but we'll deal with it. I think what we'll do when we do our root cause analysis, we'll also engage with this issue going forward.
The back.
Sir, I just want to caution from an HR point of view. It might be difficult at the point they are doing the audit to ascertain whether a CFO has not done what they needed to do because they did not have the skill. It might need a certain assessment to be done, and therefore it might be difficult for them up front to say, this CFO does not have the skill, or this CFO is just not willing to do the job. But then that's where leadership comes in, to say, let's dig deeper. Why was this not done? Is it an issue of skill? Is it an issue of unwillingness to do the job?
Yeah. No, I think we also need to be realistic as to how far can who do what. Because when it comes to a certain point, hence I raised the issue earlier, we must always go back to the question in the fabric of oversight. There's a number of role players. AG's office is one role player, all right? To what extent does the information that the AG is able to provide in his report provide sufficient insight to enable those that are supposed to take specific action to do so? Let me give an example.
if a municipality has underperformed and has a qualified report, and the reason behind that is because the municipality lacks capacity, the question, of course, is going to be what form of capacity? Is it a human resource capacity, or is it a financial capacity or capital capacity? If they can't produce clean water, maybe their machinery is too old to be able to clean the water. Now, that's capital investment, I mean, straightforward. Whether you bring an engineer there, he's not going to fix the problem unless he can build a new machine. So clearly there's a need to invest in a new machine. I think those specifics, the AG's report should be able to break down and say whether it's human resource, finance, etc. All right. Now, if the capacity relates to one of them, all right, there may be further details, all right, in relation to why is the machine not working, has it not been properly serviced, etc. You see, somebody might say that breakdown can still be done by the AG's office. But there is a point at which you can't do further breakdown, all right, at the level of the AG. Or it's not even so necessary. It's simply a question that says whoever is in a leadership position should account and say what is it that they are doing to fix the problem, and not go too much deep into semantics about, no, the thing is they advertised the job, but for 3 months we didn't get the right applicants and so on. You can go deeper and deeper and deeper to a point where it becomes absurd. So at some point we need to say leadership needs to be demonstrated. There's a mayor, there's a city manager, what have they done about the problem? And put emphasis there, you know. So in a sense, I agree with Honorable Zed that there is a need to get clarity. Some what you said, an analysis, but I also agree with the HR director there that there is a point to which you can take that kind of analysis, and you can't really go beyond that point. So we need to find the right balance. But you have the other questions to respond to?
Maybe just on this point, to provide clarity, which is linked to that whole issue of our own Deloitte managerial secondments in relation to consultants and whether or not this may not be a contradiction. The way we look at it, Chair, is that if you look at let's take an example, the Department of Water Affairs. One of the things that they have in their programs is the ongoing rehabilitation and maintenance of dams that hold water across the whole country. And the reality is that type of work for them to employ a number of engineers on their full-time staff might become a challenge. Either they will not find those engineers in large numbers so that they can ensure that they can continue to do what needs to be done in them to keep them rehabilitated and maintained. And in essence, if you look at their budgets and the estimates of national expenditure documents, there's a line there for consulting services, because they know that for them to effectively deliver what is expected of them, they will need to go and get an existing firm to come and do this thing at intervals, because those kind of things are done normally as planned maintenance, either in 1 month or the full year. It's not something that they do every day and so on. So in approaching this area of use of consultants, we are in no way saying that there is no space for use of consultants. All we're saying is we are evaluating the treaties insofar as arriving at a decision to use consultants. So we're not really professing a view that says no use of consultants. Hence, that principle will also apply to us in terms of the Deloitte managerial settlement. But I'll leave the detail of that to the section that we're going to deal with that, so that we can share with the committee how we arrived at getting people seconded into our office. But I think as a principle, there is room for consulting services in various parts of government. And the question that we're trying to deal with is there due consideration given to the decision making and therefore the output after it has been received? Does somebody apply themselves to it? So I think that's where we want them to position that area. And then on the issue of clean audits, the meaning of this in relation to adverse, disclaimer, qualified, and all of that. Maybe let me just use an example, Chair, and please, if I say something that is not in order, I'm happy to be ruled out. But the way I look at this is if a clean audit, and I'm standing on top of Table Mountain on the edge, and I know that as I'm standing there on that rock at the top of Table Mountain, if the wind blows my way, I could find myself right down there, I'll fall over, as compared to me standing at the top of Table Mountain, but in the middle somewhere. Even if the wind blows, I know that I'm not going to fall over. Now, that's a specific risk that we're identifying here. We are saying that, remember, as you're standing on the edge of that mountain, you know, if this wind is, this southeasterly is heavy, you might find that, you know, you're no longer on the top of it. And I think that's what we are trying to communicate here. We're saying that if you are standing in the middle, you are clean, because even if the wind blows either way, the chances are that you might still remain standing on the top of the mountain. But the chances when you are on the edge, you probably will find yourself perhaps somewhere else. So, to the extent... To the extent that a department, and I think I must also contextualize this, that an audit in this context is an attempt that we are making to express an opinion in all material respects. And therefore the focus here is going to be insofar as all the material items in the financial statements are concerned. If somebody gave petty cash vouchers 5 times a month to somebody to go buy them lunch, for example, in the Department of Foreign Affairs, we are still expressing an opinion that we believe is clean in all material respects, because the accumulated value of those lunches that were bought 5 times every week is still not going to change our opinion, because in relation to the 81 or 80 billion expenditure of a department, that is not material in the big picture. So there's that silent element here which is contained in the detail of the audit report. It says that in our opinion, the financial statements present fairly, and I think one of the objectives here is that the audit report is expected to express an opinion on fair presentation, which means that it's a presentation that is unlikely to mislead somebody. It's not about the truth and correctness, absolutely, of every item that is sitting in those accounts. And therefore, when we come to regarding an opinion like that as clean, we are saying that insofar as the material issues are concerned in this financial statement, you can rest assured that you are unlikely to fall over the cliff. And that's what we're trying to communicate. And therefore, reference to clean is about you've got all the necessary things that need to be in place to produce a set of accounts that can be relied upon. You've got people that check on them, and you've got people that produce a report about the condition of this department as it produces these accounts. So that's really the message that we're trying to drive there. And then the issue of the lack of maintenance of infrastructure, is it going to be incorporated in our performance audit? As we said, we felt that there's quite a wide range of issues that we can cover in performance audit. But if this is one of those issues that we need to engage with, we probably will consider it. And maybe let me link this to the other suggestion that Honorable Singh raised with regard to health and housing. When we arrived at these three, we had the full basket of possibilities. Housing was one of them. Health was one of them. Various other service delivery related areas was another. And we therefore said that in order to help us classify and hone in on the ones that we believe are going to have a large public impact, we identified a number of criteria that we will use to measure those ones. So these ones are the ones that came top three in the list of about 52 different areas. And I can assure you, Honorable Member, that the Lights of Health, the Lights of Housing are following very closely on these three. We haven't ignored them, but we know that a performance audit engagement is where you look at it every year to say, are we still on the path of relevance on this one, or should we not bring another? So certainly we have looked at a wide range of things, and we've used rules that we developed ourselves through what we have in the office as a performance audit advisory committee, which is chaired by the AG, together with a number of players in the office, where we evaluate where we want to put our best foot forward. And in doing it, we also take into account also the fact that we are in building phase when it comes to the skills that are required for this, because this is not a comfortable space for a traditional auditor and an accountant, because it brings with it some other peculiarities that have a lot to do with other skills. And in building to this, we also don't want to put ourselves at risk and identify a lot of complex topics. When we have to answer to them, we will find ourselves wanting. So we're also doing this on a lighter note with a view to building the capacity and the skills that are required to do it sustainably. Thanks, Chair.
Skills happen both ways. Even the auditors themselves need to build capacity and skills. All right. I want us to pause for tea before. Right. I want us to pause for a few minutes before they take the tea away before we have it. I noticed there is a practice here in Parliament these days. Immediately after you finish having your tea, they take all your sandwiches and your tea away. And apparently the rule is that you're no longer allowed to put the food inside the room. So, and the 11 o'clock tea doesn't come with any sandwiches. So we need to change some of these rules. I think they're unreasonable.
Chairperson,
yes,
before we break for tea, can I suggest that when the DAG comes back, he takes us through on a broad brush until about 10 past 12, because, you know, we're only on page 7, and we're going to finish by 12:45. So it gives us about 30 minutes to engage, so that because we understand that this is a process. It's not we're not going to end this, but at least if he takes us on a broad brush of the entire presentation, then, you know, if we don't finish all our questions and you don't have all the answers, at another occasion we may engage.
You'll be a good friend of Honorable Tlake, Manana Tlake, because that's what she was pushing for earlier. All right. Well, in any case, at the beginning, we did indicate that we do not envisage this process to be completed today. We wouldn't be in a position, really. I'm sure that Honorable Zerbe would want to probe further the area of, well, you haven't heard what I said, do you want to probe what? But anyway, let me not speak for you. You can speak for yourself. Hello? I thought you were objecting to me saying that I know you would want to probe further on something, but maybe we can let it go. All right, then tea break, and then we'll be back in 10 minutes.
Okay, that's fine. We can proceed with that. I can't believe you were threatening to get hold of me because I never got a missed call or a message, even an email from you. So I wonder when it's coming again. When? I never got to work with Chantel. I never got one. But I will pick that up with it. I've been out of office. I've been out of office. But I will pick that up. And therefore, then we have a single charge out rate, irrespective of what the business executive earns. And I was adding to that, Chair, when I said to Honorable Singh that under note 3.3.2, the business executive salary band, where it starts and where it ends, is in fact contained on that table.
Page 49. Honorable Singh, are you satisfied? Do you want to make any follow-up?
He's ordered in it, sir.
I could have omitted that. I'm trying to look for 49, sir.
It's the note 3.3.2.
Oh, pretty soon. The way the pages are done.
Oh, yes, the number there and the average band. Okay, great. Thank you.
Chairperson,
so that's where the answer comes.
Yes. Chair, I do believe the issue of the performance bonus remains unanswered. And basically, we are reflecting a growth from we had originally the prior year's projected 12 million to 20 million. But that is really not a significant growth when you consider the growth in our payroll costs, total payroll costs. So it's increased from 1.61% overall to 2.3% overall. And obviously that is in a part of a deliberate strategy as part of our overall retention of employees, et cetera, et cetera. Chair, I'm not sure if there are any other unanswered questions. I'll be happy to deal with them. Oh, the computer hardware, that the depreciation you are seeing on the table, in fact, talks to the very short...
That page?
Yeah, 69.
Right.
Yeah. I think the question was our acquisitions and depreciation, et cetera, et cetera. Dear Chairperson, the lifespan of the computer hardware is relatively short, and that's why you're finding the accelerated depreciation being reflected. And then there was a question on the computer.
Sorry, the question hasn't been answered.
Oh.
That's exactly the point that I was making. The depreciation is accelerating, but the acquisition is, in fact, not doing the other thing. It's decreasing. And it's the balance between the acquisition and the depreciation that I don't see. All right?
Quickly, maybe add to that answer.
Yeah.
The computer hardware, I think the issue here in terms of the forecast, what you see, the 28059 is the net carrying value of the computer hardware. Now, what is projected here in terms of the depreciation is that in the year 2010-11, the bulk of that carrying value is going to be charged through depreciation, because it's possible that that computer hardware is probably nearing the end of its useful life, which is probably 3 or I don't know how many years it is that's left to be written off. So now with the acquisition of 19767, less the depreciation, that 27241, the large portion of it is what is sitting under 28059, the net carrying value balance, which is going to go through the depreciation. And then if you add the acquisition, the net carrying value for the new year becomes 20585 because of the last bit of depreciation coming through the net carrying value, which is going to be the opening balance for the new year.
Making any sense? So, Chair, I'm not convinced. It still doesn't explain why the amount of acquisition is less than the amount of depreciation.
Sorry, Chair, there's no link between the two. The 28059 is the net carrying value of the assets at the end of this financial year that we're referring to. Let's assume that we didn't acquire anything. When we depreciate that asset on its net carrying value, at the end of that year, we potentially could be reflecting a 1 million balance because the 27 million would have been depreciated fully in that financial year. So when we acquire an additional computer hardware during the year, it gets added on to whatever balance is left from the net carrying value. So in terms of the operation of a depreciation cycle, there's no relationship between it and an acquisition, because the acquisition is really acquiring the item of hardware at cost. But what we are doing here, we're saying that we're going to charge to the income statement a depreciation largely of the amount that is coming from the opening balance of 28059. So it's really a debit and credit exercise according to what's in the paper. But between the two, a depreciation and an acquisition, there's no direct relationship.
Chair, Chair, if I could just add to that, I think Honorable Steele's concern may be coming from a perspective that says, well, operationally you may compromise yourself going into the future. I think that's where you're coming from. However, I wish to perhaps give you some comfort, yes, that in fact there is an ongoing deliberate strategy around acquisition of computer hardware, etc., because that is something that we look at on a three-year cycle, but also annually then make commitments in terms of how we're going to go about purchasing it. You probably find historically what has happened is that there was a fairly heavy investment initially that's now coming to an end of its useful life, and therefore then we're going into a next cycle now.
Right. Is the next cycle reflected in a significant projected rise in acquisition, or whatever?
Not necessarily, Chair. You know, although we may write off for the books, we may write off the equipment, but in terms of its useful
life, in reality, it's still
working. It would continue for a bit, yeah.
Mm.
And then the other thing that influences that are your laptops as well, and that's purchased on a three-year cycle, right? So the picture can be somewhat erratic when one looks at it purely from the book's perspective.
I see it with cars. You find your car book valued depreciates at such phenomenal rates, but you get into the car and you start driving it, it's in perfect condition. Much more reliable than some of the brand new cars that break down in 6 months. All right. Mr. Steele, are you happy?
Yes, I'm happy.
Grimy?
I'm happy with that. It's just the security amount on page 69 as well that I queried.
All right. Let's hear that.
Yeah, Chair, on that one there, you know, there was an investment in an external server, you know, for backup purposes. And that was a once-off kind of cost. However, I wish to give comfort to honorable colleagues that our environment is well secured and we often get audited as far as that is concerned as well. So that would basically explain the negative movement. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. I wonder if there's anybody who still uses the manual typewriter these days. It's just become an antique. All right. Any other questions that still needed to be answered? Honorable George?
There were two questions that didn't get answered of mine.
All right.
One was the medical examinations, and the other one was the interviews. Thank you, Chair.
All right. Let's hear that.
Chair, as far as the interviews are concerned, I think we are not paying people to come for interviews, if that's the interpretation of that. But basically, it's a kind of cost that's attached around arranging the interviews, traveling to interviews for our internal resources. So it's not that we're paying candidates to come. Okay.
Isn't the practice to pay for the cost of accommodation,
the S&T,
travel, and so on?
The S&T, I just wanted to give Dr. George comfort. We're not paying them for the time to come for the interview, which I think was his primary concern. As far as medical examinations
are concerned, what do you pay for? I just wanted to understand. What is it that you say you pay for? S&T.
The S&T around the interview, Chair.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. As far as the medical examinations are concerned, you'd probably find that, again, this has been a somewhat of a new allocation in the budgeting process, which would normally have been covered through the EWP, the wellness program. So I don't think it's anything extraordinary. You know, it would be a case of if an employee through the wellness program went to a specialist for a particular examination or something like that. I don't think it's anything specific to do with the environment. We're certainly not sending people for HIV tests and stuff like that. You know? So it's just an allocation thing, really, at the end of the day.
All right. Let's start with Honorable Singh and then back to Dr. George.
Chair, I thought we had done with the financials and that we had the audit tariffs and audit directive to look at, and whether we need to postpone discussion on that or approve the audit.
I was given a specific request that there will be the dwindling of numbers, especially from the ANC side, and whether we shouldn't consider shelving the rest of the engagement for the next round. Are we scheduled for the meeting next week? How do we want to proceed? Let me get guidance from the meeting. We're not scheduled for next week. Is it generally a free a day for us? All right. Yes, AG, you wanted to say something?
Now, Chair, I was going to suggest perhaps that if we do adjourn, we can finalize anything to do with the body of the strategic plan and budget, and then only defer the session for the other two aspects, which is the tariffs and the directive. At least we would have covered some ground, because while we're doing those in the next meeting, at least members would have had the essence of the meaning of the messages in the strike book.
Am I guaranteed that the remaining standing soldiers will soldier on till the end today, so that we finish that part? Are we all happy with that?
Unfortunately, Chairperson, I don't think myself and Honorable Smith will still make it.
Honorable Singh himself did indicate that he's going to request to be relieved about. Was it you? After
That's my whip there. Although she's not a party, she's a whip. So if she says I must go, then I must go. I'll miss my flight.
How convenient.
I'm sorry to do this.
How convenient. So it does seem as if the general proposal is that we unfortunately must shelve until next week, Friday. Have I missed something?
Until a date to be determined.
Oh, until a date to be determined.
Yeah, but not next Friday.
Why not next Friday?
Because we're trying to organize so that we don't have meetings next Friday, I think, aren't we, generally?
Oh, so there's some kind of a lobby that I have not picked up. Yes, Secretary, can you clarify this matter? Somehow the chair has lost control over matters. All right. Use your mic and address the meeting.
Chairperson, on the committee program that was approved by the House Chair, we're supposed to have oversight to the municipalities that a resolution that was made in the past meeting. But now, since the municipalities have not been identified, those that we can visit, next week it was only for oversight. And when I checked with some of the members, most of them will not be available next week.
There is a roadshow schedule of dates, and that's the other matter that we need to expedite. It does seem from the look of things that we would, if we're not meeting next week, it means we won't even be able to sit to consider that schedule of dates. And therefore it means that, beyond next week there would be very little time to sit and consider dates and still be able to plan the logistics to even catch the fourth and the fifth. So the long and short of it seems to me we'll miss out on the idea of piggybacking on the roadshow to do our oversight. It looks like we're talking about oversight program possibly sometime further on, beyond the dates. Like I said, the dates here show the 15th to the 5th of November, 15th of October to the 5th of November. I'm not sure whether we will be in a position to finalize and agree on. So even the potential of us going out next week is out of the question, because the feedback I'm getting from the secretary is that none of you confirmed availability of attending next week. In any case, at this stage, it would be too short of a notice. So the two matters here, insofar as the program is concerned, one is the need to finalize this work, and two is for us to agree on an alternative arrangement with regard to the oversight. That is, if we're still committed to doing oversight. Honorable Singh, you want to
ask? Chairperson, may I make a suggestion on the oversight?
Right.
I just want to know if those dates are cast in stone. Because from when I looked here, it would seem that the Eastern Cape...
By the way, those are not our dates.
The dates, yeah, that's why I'm asking through you, Chairperson, to the Office
right.
of the AG. Because the one area that I think which will be important for us to go as a collective is the Eastern Cape. Because in that region, there's a very good example and a very bad example. The Nelson Mandela Metro is unqualified, and there's Sunday's River that is disclaimer.
And, of course, the Northwest has been quite household name lately on the best book side.
Maybe we can do a round robin on that, off, you know, to see when we can go on that oversight visit. But I think for our meeting here, for the adjourned meeting, I don't know whether we would need more than an hour, and probably we need to consider an evening next week. If the AG's team are available. You know, the night before we sat till 8:30 in appropriations. And then maybe, I don't know, Tuesday evening or Wednesday evening or something, we can round robin.
You see, the trick also is availability of members. Now, if members are not here to confirm, we can all leave thinking that we've agreed on something. And only to realize it won't materialize, because nobody will be there. Only a handful of people will be there. So maybe let's not attempt to do a date in sitting here, because it won't be possible. Most people are not here. We'll first check availability of the AG's office going forward, check members' availability, and then check approval with Parliament. Such a tricky exercise. Anyway, DAG, you wanted to say something? All right. So that's where we are. It seems as if, AG, your wish, which was my wish too, that we proceed, is not succeeding. And therefore, we need to then adjourn on the note that we will again go back to the drawing board, interface with yourselves, interface with the members, interface with Parliament, and identify an alternative date both for our next meeting as well as how we resolve the issue of oversight. Hopefully we'll go to visit Honorable Service Municipality and check how the spending and the accounting there has happened. Honorable Steele?
Thank you, Chair. I just don't want to lose sight of the two matters that I did raise earlier on the risk management and the materiality, if those could be reported at our next meeting by follow-up, please.
All right. Is that, are you happy with that, DAG?
Yeah, that's fine, Chair.
All right, unless anybody wishes to raise something which, without which the sky will fall or it will stop raining. Going, gone. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
I mean, we don't have a conversation.